This is Dori Smith. Welcome to a one-hour Talk Nation radio special on forming a more perfect union with David Swanson. His 2009 book is Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. It's out from Seven Stories Press. And after we read it, we wanted to spend a full hour with David discussing his book and his calls to action.
It's lovely to have a president who can speak in complete English sentences, but it doesn't save any lives. A great many of us will more than likely be going to jail for nonviolent resistance to these wars.
David Swanson is Washington director of Democrats.com and a board member of Progressive Democrats for America. He was press secretary to Ohio representative and former U.S. presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich during his 2004 campaign. And he's been a leading voice for the prosecution of former President Bush and Vice President Cheney for war crimes.
Expand Medicare by allowing people under 65 to buy into it. MobilizeForHealthcare.org.
We spoke with him as he was preparing for talks throughout the weekend of October 2nd and likely arrest the week after for protesting the U.S. insurance industry and its impact on healthcare. David Swanson, welcome.
Thanks for having me on. Great to be here.
This is a book that centers on a lot of the work you've been doing, but you also explore new areas here and really getting into activism. And I want to start by asking you about some of the activism that's going on right now, because there have been some arrests, and you've been reporting this on the website afterdowningstreet.org, 16 arrested, 99 Park Avenue in New York City, for entering the lobby of the health insurance company Aetna. Would you just explain what happened there and what is happening around taking on the insurance industry?
Well, you can find links at afterdowningstreet.org, or you can go straight to mobilizeforhealthcare.org. This is a coalition that's formed of people who support single-payer Medicare for all, or at least moving the debate in a positive direction, who are fed up with insurance companies for controlling our Congress and for denying care. There was a study that came out recently from Harvard of 44,000 Americans a year dying for lack of health care. We have not just 40 or 50 million people without health care coverage, but we have a huge percentage of those who have insurance who get turned down when they actually get sick. So you pay all of this money for so-called health insurance, and then it doesn't cover you. And so these are people going to the offices of the insurance companies to say, we want you to stop denying coverage of necessary procedures approved by doctors. And so a crowd of New Yorkers went the other day to Aetna, and I think it was 16, I've also heard 17, people refused to leave the lobby where they were handing out information and chanting and talking, and they were arrested. And there were, at that point, over 300, now there are over 550 people signed up on that website as ready and eager to risk arrest to get this message across.
Now, the Democrats are fundraising for the next election cycle right now, and they're mentioning some of the efforts in Congress surrounding health care. One of the latest fundraising letters was very interesting. Mitch Stewart of Organizing for America talking about a cavalry of doctors, half a million strong, millions of nurses, who he says are joining forces to help pass real health reform. If you could speak to this cavalry, what would you say, David Swanson?
Well, I would say join Physicians for a National Health Program. I would say join with California nurses and the other nurses associations that are really fighting for serious health care reform. That is single-payer health care, what every other wealthy nation in the world has figured out. Get rid of these insurance companies. And by moving the debate in that direction, you don't guarantee that we'll get it this week, but you do radically improve the chances of getting a bill that does more good than harm, that moves us in the right direction. I mean, this was how they got progressives and labor on board with the public option many months ago, was to define it as a step that would move us to single payer, because it would create an option that was so attractive and so efficient that more and more people would buy into it, and we would end up with single payer. It's now through this process in Washington that began with the fight for the public option and censored any mention of single payer, gotten to the point where the president is explicitly defining the public option as something that will never have more than 5% of Americans and will be no threat whatsoever to the insurance companies. This is how the debate goes down when we self-censor, when we pre-compromise, when we as activist groups, including doctors and nurses, fail to speak our minds and think we're being strategic insiders. When we're not, we're failing in our more important role as citizens.
You're suggesting that the idea of, you know, compromise early so you can actually get a bill through, give them something they can actually pass, that kind of dialogue that we've been hearing is wrong-headed. Now, also, let me ask you, David, about insurance companies, because I'm speaking to you from very near the insurance capital of America. That would be Hartford, Connecticut. And I believe Aetna was for many years based here. Who knows where they're really based today? But, you know, a lot of the insurance companies have big offices here and lots of employees. So are you really saying get rid of the insurance companies? Are you saying tame them down? What would happen there? And how does this benefit America? Because it could, at least to some extent, be a challenge for people trying to bolster up our economy, right?
The California Nurses Association did a study of what would be the economic impact of going to single payer, which, yes, would mean getting rid of the health insurance companies as we know them, and found that there would be a net gain of millions of jobs. Now, that doesn't guarantee that we get a new job of the same quality in the same location for everyone who currently works, not just in Hartford, but all over the country, for these insurance companies. We do need a concerted effort in that regard. I mean, look, I want to shut down 1,000 military bases around the world and bring 600,000 people home. I want to find them new jobs. I think the fact that somebody has a job in an enterprise is not a defense of that enterprise if it's destroying the world or our nation. And that's what health insurance companies are doing. Alan Grayson talking about the plan to leave things as is and people should just not get sick or if they do, die quickly. That's not hyperbole. That's not tongue-in-cheek. That's straight up what's going on. And people should not be ashamed of having jobs to feed their families. They are probably working very hard and not making enough as it is in a very stressful occupation, but they should be ashamed of working for such companies and should want to get out of it and should want different jobs. And there's no reason we can't provide them with honorable jobs in a reshaped marketplace.
Of course, there's no guarantee that the insurance company you work for won't outsource you. We have a plant closing here, a Pratt & Whitney facility, in fact.
Well, there's the next best thing to a guarantee. If the government passes a bill that requires that U.S. citizens purchase products from health insurance companies, most of which have quasi-monopolies in various regions of the country, that's about as close you can get to a guarantee. Same with the weapons industry, which is, of course, far and away our biggest industry. There are nearly guarantees of ongoing jobs, not for any particular individual, but for a segment of the population. That, again, provides no reason why we should keep health insurance companies around when they do far more harm than good. In fact, it's not clear what good at all they do anybody.
Well, the doctors didn't apparently have that much success at taking them on when it was a matter of, remember, managed care. I mean, now everyone's managed, including those doctors, right?
Absolutely. I mean, Physicians for a National Health Program is a huge coalition of doctors who actually want to be able to make decisions about health care, who want to be able to work with patients, get to know patients, serve them preventively as well as when a crisis arises, and want to cut out the middleman and get the insurance companies out of the way, which don't just eat up approximately a third of our money that goes into health care, but actually interfere in the process, deny people care that they need that's approved by their doctors, and slow everything down with their incredible bureaucracy and waste and advertising and paperwork and lobbying and 6 lobbyists at the moment per Congress member. It's so bizarre that you have this brainless opposition to single-payer health care on the grounds that governments are inefficient and bureaucratic, when Medicare has an overhead of 3% and these insurance companies have an overhead of at least 30%.
Well, it was Tom Hartman that I heard recently talking about the fact that wealthy Americans pay less tax relative to those who earn less than $100,000. This is a big deal that he was discussing. Tom Hartman, who loves your book, by the way.
Tom Hartman had a great proposal on health care. He said, let's just expand Medicare. Don't change anything. You know, we can improve Medicare as we go along, but let's just expand Medicare by allowing people under 65 to buy into it and to buy into it at the exact same cost as it costs Medicare to serve them, so that there is no budgetary question, absolutely revenue neutral, no new policies that can be lied about with claims of death panels and killing grandma and so forth. Very easy, very simple, makes complete sense. You could do it in stages, bring it down to 55, down to 45, down to 35, until we get down to infants. And I think it's brilliant, but being brilliant has absolutely no impact on Washington, where the corrupting forces of the corporate media, of party discipline, and above all, of the money coming from the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies and so forth, decides everything. It is true that if we had single-payer health care, we would have to pay for it. And I would want to tax corporations. I would want to tax the wealthy. I would want to take away the cap on paying Social Security taxes if you're rich and so forth. And it could be very easily done. And in fact, the taxes are rather minimal and are built into the bill, H.R. 676, as drafted by Congressman John Conyers. But we would, as a society, be paying far less. And most people would be paying far less, would be doing none of the paperwork, none of the hassle, none of the delays, and would have guaranteed preventive as well as emergency health care. Regardless, you walk into any hospital, any doctor, not just the ones your insurance company approves of, and you get treated with no bill to take home. How anyone can be organized by an insurance company front group to go out and rally against that is beyond me.
I want to turn to the chapter in your book, Taking Action, where you open with a question. How exactly do we compel our government to give us what we want, to create appropriate laws and obey them, to establish appropriate rights and respect them, to follow our lead in actually creating transformational change that we don't have to believe in because we can see it? One thing is clear, you say, voting the least of our tools and responsibilities. A democratic and honest system of elections is essential, but even with such a thing in place, most of our work should begin the day after Election Day. And then you say, this is so interesting, many of us are struggling financially and otherwise. We have immediate problems and short-term goals, but we need to be strategic about using our immediate struggles to build organizations and patterns of behavior that can win larger victories down the road, including seemingly esoteric victories in redesigning the structure of our government. When Paulson's plunder bailout was originally proposed in 2008, you say the public outrage was tremendous. Congress and the media flooded with calls and emails. 90% were against the thing. Momentarily, you write, we won. The House voted no. But that victory did not last. The influences of money, media, and party quickly regrouped and overpowered us. We did not have the strength to withstand the assault. If we are ever to have that strength, we will need to limit the influence of money, create truly independent media, and bust up the monopolies on political power and decision-making now headquartered in parties. And we will have to be active and organized. So, David Swanson, it doesn't end with the elections that the Democratic Party keeps sending me emails about?
We have to get away from the idea that elections are all there is, or even most of what there is in the life of a citizen in a representative republic, and then away from this idea that following an election, it's appropriate to sit back and see what the new people do. You know, that's appropriate following a coup, not following an election. following an election, it's appropriate to get out and tell them how you want to be represented, including how you want to be represented differently from what your opinions were before the election, if your opinions change as the facts change and your thinking changes. So, you know, we now have a clear majority against all of the wars that we're fighting, and maybe we didn't before the election. That's not relevant. What's relevant is where the American people are, and it's our job to pressure our so-called representatives to represent us. So, you know, we spend all of this focus on elections. We go out and register people to vote. We have to get rid of that. People simply have to be registered when they turn 18 so that this busy work is not taking the place of real activism. Real activism is communicating our demands to our representatives year in and year out, politely and otherwise as needed. And of course, it's an uphill fight because we have to clean up the money influence and the corporate media influence, which is far and away the number one excuse you get from Congress members. Oh, no, the media would attack me. We have to get rid of the incredible monopoly on power that the two parties have. But we can fight and win victories even in this unlevel playing field that we've got to work with now. And we can do that best, I think, by ceasing to focus on the president, either to influence him or to wait for him to behave as a benevolent dictator and fix everything for us, and avoiding the idea that we have much control at all over senators, and looking at the House, where we do have a fighting chance, where we can get organized enough with a handful of people to influence House members, or at least to improve the caliber of candidates coming against them in the next election. Elections are important. We couldn't do without them. But it's what happens in between that matters the most. And you can find out where these House members will be and speak to them face to face. You can find their offices and their homes, and you can address them in the local media and build your own better media. And you can sit in their offices and go to jail to get a point across, and it can be very, very effective. And on that agenda need to be things that Congress isn't talking about at all. So it's not just better health care than what they want to give us. It's also the important task of restoring power to Congress. And your Congress member doesn't want any power. They do not want power as against the executive branch. But the executive branch is never going to give back power voluntarily. And only through our representatives of Congress can we take it back.
Well, in Chapter 2, you write about the powers of war, and on page 51, you talk about the pressure that is on the president right now, President Obama, being pressured to escalate and launch illegal wars, which you say it's very intense. And I want to ask you about the Project for a New American Century, because you make a comment about what they did with their website that I found fascinating.
Their website and the institution was gone for some years and then came back last year. And we are seeing from them and from the usual suspects and much of the corporate media in a disturbingly similar way, a push to attack Iran that is so similar to the push to attack Iraq. And we've seen this for years now, and we've had false claims about Iran and Iranian weapons and Iranian actions in Iraq and elsewhere. But we're now seeing the claims about weapons of mass destruction with no basis whatsoever. And we've sort of dropped the idea that you have to have the lies about a tie to 9/11. With Iraq, you had at least those two sets of lies, the weapons and the lies about ties to 9/11, which together added up to nothing resembling a legal case for war, but were depicted as such. Now we don't even have the ties to 9/11 claim. We just have the false claims about possessing weapons or considering the possibility of possessing weapons in the future. That is being used now openly as an argument for an attack on Iran by the United States or by Israel. So we have to maintain eternal vigilance. I mean, we've done a world of good by exposing the lies about Iraq, which has thus far dissuaded the vast majority of Americans from supporting any sort of escalation with Iran, and yet we're moving rapidly in that direction, step by step. We're going to go to tougher sanctions and so forth, and you're going to see responses from Iran that can then be depicted as escalating the conflict. We have to be very, very careful, and we would be far better off if we had control of Congress and Congress had control of the power to make war, and it doesn't. The president has that. The president now launches strikes with drones without asking anybody's permission into brand new countries. And that may not seem like war to Americans because none of their sons and daughters are there on the ground, but it seems like war to the nation being bombed by the drones. There's a conference happening in Washington, D.C. coming up October 2nd and 3rd, where we're going to look at this question of where the power to make war should be with all kinds of experts. And then on October 5th, we are going to see serious protests in D.C. around this opening of a ninth year in Afghanistan. So there are some encouraging signs. There's more awareness and activism out there than we're told, but it's not nearly enough.
David, where can people find out more beyond your website, afterdowningstreet.org? Because I know you've got a lot of organizing going on.
I'll be speaking at this conference October 2nd and 3rd, whodecidesaboutwar.org, which is at afterdowningstreet.org. And then on October 5th, a great many of us will more than likely be going to jail for nonviolent resistance to these wars to get across the message that not only does a majority of Americans want to end these wars, but some segment of that majority is willing to get out and take risks to make their voices heard. So I would encourage people to go to nogoodwar.org or afterdowningstreet.org and by all means join us. But there will be protests already organized in the coming weeks all over the country as we go into a ninth year in Afghanistan. And I encourage people to make their voices heard, especially to their representative in the House.
One thing you do mention in your book that intrigued me very much is Obama and the Constitution, because when you're talking about the limits of the presidency, that's where they sit in the Constitution. Barack Obama, a constitutional law specialist, an expert, right?
So we're told, but you haven't seen any signs of it. I mean, we saw a speech in front of the Constitution in the National Archives in which he declared the right to throw out habeas corpus, which is, you know, one of the very few rights actually contained in the Constitution, not even in the amendments. So we have signs of better changes and much improved rhetoric, and it's lovely to have a president who can speak in complete English sentences, but it doesn't save any lives. And so when we're told that signing statements will now be written only when they really, really have to be, and we'll release White House visitor logs, though not the past ones about the health insurance executives, we'll keep those secret, except when we think national security is an issue, then we'll go on keeping them secret. And we're going to only shout state secrets to block court cases, entire court cases, not pieces of information. This is beyond Bush and Cheney. Only after we have all our lawyers carefully look it over. Well, none of these reforms that are all trumpeted by progressive groups as, oh, finally something good, none of them give an ounce of power to any branch of government other than the White House, the executive branch, or what we used to think of as the executive branch executing the will of Congress. We think so much in terms of parties now as if the two structures in Washington are two parties that no one even remembers that they learned in elementary school about the three branches of our government.
David Swanson, Congress does appear to be working against the more progressive policies that have been proposed. And it's as if Congress were still dominated by Republicans. So if we do press for a reversal of executive power, are we in some way limiting what the president can do to try to carry out the kinds of promises that he made? Or are we pressuring him to make good on them? I mean, in other words, how do we strengthen his abilities to deal with Congress and at the same time ask him to limit himself?
Well, the president made some promises that he's broken that had to do specifically with limiting presidential power. He promised not to use signing statements in the way that he has, not as egregiously, not as frequently as his predecessor, but he has. He promised to make White House meetings public and broadcast on C-SPAN or on the Internet, and we haven't seen any of that. We saw promises about reforming NAFTA that have been completely dropped. I mean, there's an endless list of all variety of promises that have been dropped, but we shouldn't think of a president as being able to promise legislation. A president should be able to promise his support, his signature, his advice on legislation, but no more. I wouldn't want a president to be able to make such a promise. Now, President Obama did not promise much at all on health care, but what he did, he's gone back on some of it in terms of his support for different measures. But that's all it should be. We shouldn't want a president to be able to actually legislate. And when we see these progressive Democrats in Congress complaining that the president won't write the bill for them, complaining that he won't order them to do better, I mean, there's a fundamental problem there in that the legislature is supposed to be the legislature and the president is supposed to execute its will. The other problem is, of course, that backstage Obama has been walking the Democrats along step by step through this disastrous process and is as corrupt and ill-intentioned as the rest of them on health care. I think that when you do talk about moving powers to Congress, it is appropriate to ask then, well, what good would that do when Congress is so corrupt? But it is through Congress that we have any chance, and we absolutely must reform Congress in terms of the money and the media and the gerrymandering and the ballot access and the rest of it. But you can't get to a point where you've reformed the presidency to where you expect to be able as a citizen to lobby a president, right? A president can ignore whole regions of the country. In today's corrupt system, takes 10 times the money of any senator. You can't talk to a president. The Secret Service surrounds him. He's in there for 4 years, not two. It's very, very difficult. But with your representative in the House, you can influence them. You can even replace them. It's hard. It's not a fair level playing field, and it needs to be, but you can. And so if Congress had any say over whether we go into wars or not, and if the people had any control over Congress, we wouldn't have some of these wars, and we would end them much more quickly. And I know that that's two major steps we have to take to move power to Congress and to reform the Congress. But I don't see any other easier path.
Just comment on what President Barack Obama said. It's quoted in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Protesters at the recent G20, quote, "Maybe the protesters are missing this, that I and other world leaders are very interested in making sure that the excesses of global finance are reined in." What do you make of that?
Well, I'd say first I'll believe it when I see it. I would love to hear some good news out of there. I haven't yet. But President Obama ought to have been criticizing the militarized police force that was rioting unprovoked and restraining the rights of citizens to speech and assembly, very intentionally so, explicitly so, and claiming success and using militaristic weaponry to do so against U.S. citizens. We see rallies, even rallies with the president himself, at which people are shouting and screaming for right-wing causes and threatening his assassination and carrying guns. And you don't see this police presence, this military presence, this abuse of those people's rights. Their rights are extended, I think, beyond reasonable measure. But where you have masses of U.S. citizens protesting against what is really a corporate agenda, you know, not screaming about socialism, but screaming about corporatism, there you have this crackdown. And there's video footage, and the president cannot be unaware of it, even if the networks haven't shown it to the average U.S. citizen and have given far more coverage to the nuts threatening violence against minorities and carrying guns who not only go to rallies but are then put on television to talk about it. I think that the president's remarks are far off topic, as are his scaremongering remarks about Iran made in the same venue.
You're listening to a Talk Nation radio special, an interview with David Swanson about his book Daybreak. Swanson is co-founder of After Downing Street, the coalition formed after discovery of key documents on the British role in planning and carrying out the 2003 invasion of Iraq. In Daybreak, David Swanson goes over the details again on how former President Bush and former Prime Minister Tony Blair told their populations they were not yet decided about an invasion of Iraq, while behind closed doors they were taking steps to carry one out. Swanson then writes on page 35, that, according to journalist Seymour Hersh, former Vice President Dick Cheney also admitted in 2008 at a journalism conference that he thought about planning what would have been a reenactment of a staged event in the Gulf of Tonkin, on which the Vietnam invasion was predicated. Cheney spoke openly of a method he considered for provoking war against Iran, quoting Daybreak now. Journalist Seymour Hersh reported at a journalism conference in 2008 that at a 2008 meeting in the vice president's office, soon after an incident in the Strait of Hormuz, in which a U.S. carrier almost shot at a few small Iranian speedboats, there were a dozen ideas proffered about how to trigger a war. "The one that interested me the most," said Cheney, "was why don't we build, we in our shipyard, build 4 or 5 boats that look like Iranian PT boats, put Navy SEALs on them with a lot of arms, and next time one of our boats goes into the Strait of Hormuz, start a shoot-up. Might cost some lives, and it was rejected because you can't have Americans killing Americans," Cheney said. David Swanson asks, do these sound like the accounts of the behavior of men worthy of imperial powers?
He says, "This is my son. He's really excited to see him. Can you give him a one-word sentence to take to his classmates in social studies?" That's what he said.
This is the expert propagandist, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel, talking about a chance encounter he had with an Israeli boy who asked him for the one line he should bring back to his classroom.
I looked at that boy and I said, "Why do you want this sentence?" And he said, "Because I'm interested in the future of the world." So I said, "Okay, here's the sentence. It's 1938, and Iran is Germany."
In 2009, however, the same judge that brought Rwandan war criminals to justice, South Africa's Richard Goldstone, has called for international criminal court proceedings against Israeli leaders for war crimes in the January bombing and ground invasion of Gaza. Of 1,400 Palestinian deaths, 623 were children, and the crimes outlined in Goldstone's report have shocked the world. They include use of children as human shields. Prime Minister Netanyahu has used upcoming peace talks as a shield against prosecution at the ICC, saying he will not attend peace talks set up by the White House unless the Palestinian Authority renounces the Goldstone report. It is a precondition to peace talks President Obama said would be free of preconditions, including the settlement freeze America had called on Israel to enforce. Under pressure from both Netanyahu and the White House, the Palestinian Authority has dropped support for the Goldstone Report, according to Haaretz. Correspondents Barak Ravid and Natasha Mozgovaya also report that Prime Minister Netanyahu and Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman have applied pressure on the foreign ministers of 15 different countries, asking them to support efforts to counter Judge Goldstone's report. Brazil, Russia, the European Union, which could soon be led by Tony Blair, were told the report is a dangerous development that, quoting now, threatens the ability of democracies to defend themselves. Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman told the foreign leaders, "This is only the first step. The next step will be similar efforts against NATO forces in Afghanistan and Russian forces in Chechnya." Amid these developments, Israeli jets were bombing Gaza at the Egyptian border, and artillery fire destroyed a house in Gaza City. This at a time when peace groups are scrambling to get aid in for Palestinians displaced by the January war. The IDF claimed their attacks were in retaliation for Hamas rockets. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported Israel's attack came first. So it is against a backdrop of what could be the largest escalation of war in the Middle East yet that U.S. peace and democracy groups are gearing up to challenge the Obama administration on foreign and domestic policy.
Second time today, everybody scatters and hopes it goes away. How many kids they've murdered. Only God can say.
We return now to David Swanson, author of the book Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. It is a call to action for Americans facing the difficult task of trying to force the reversal of executive powers assumed by George W. Bush and maintained by President Obama. We asked him to talk about what Americans can learn from the way George Bush and Dick Cheney led the nation to war with the help of UK's Tony Blair.
There was a front page article in the New York Times yesterday comparing the run-up to Iraq with the current run-up to Iran, and even vaguely, partially apologizing for the New York Times role, not spelling out how extensive and decisive that role had been. But they quote people in that article yesterday and elsewhere without challenge, claiming that back in 2002, it was incredibly stupid and naive not to believe the lies. Well, that sort of garbage should not be in print. You know, Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice understood in 2001 that there were no weapons. Colin Powell went to the UN with information from Hussein Kamel, who had told them there were no weapons. But Colin Powell left out that bit. Our intelligence agencies understood in 2002, I mean, in the Downing Street minutes, you read Sir Richard Dearlove explaining that George Tenet had told him in 2002 that they understood there were no weapons, but they were going to fix the facts around the policy. When the Downing Street minutes and other pieces of evidence came out in 2005, 2006, we were told, oh, that's old news. We all knew that already. And of course they did. They did, but they didn't put it on the front page. They didn't put it on the air. They pushed the lies, knowingly pushed the lies. The corporate media was largely complicit. And so now you have these front page defenses of how they aren't pushing the lies as heavily this time around, and they weren't really lies. And we're even told by so many pundits that Iraq was actually pretending to have weapons, so it's Iraq's own fault. Even though Iraq was stating publicly over and over again, just as Iran is right now, we do not have these weapons. So we have to keep constantly exposing what ought to be well-known facts, because we are told tens of thousands of times in very subtle ways that they are not facts, that that's not what happened. And we are told that, well, this time we're being more serious and more careful, and it looks like there really is a nuclear facility in Iran. Well, of course there is. Iran announced it publicly ahead of schedule. The question is whether it's for making weapons, and there's not a scrap of evidence yet of that. So we have these questions conflated. We have all sorts of tricks used to confuse us. We have to stay on top of it.
Well, they've said it's not operational. They haven't initiated the program to enrich uranium there yet, and they don't have the mechanisms through which to do so there. You know?
Well, that's right. And then they've announced it far before the deadline by which they have to announce a new facility before it becomes operational. And we're told, oh, well, but the day before they announced it, they were keeping it secret. Well, okay, of course, but they announced it well before any requirement to announce it. There is absolutely no evidence that it has any potential to be used to make weapons. And so they haven't actually violated any laws. It doesn't mean they couldn't. It doesn't mean they shouldn't be watched. It doesn't mean that they should be permitted to violate laws or to develop nuclear weapons. But meanwhile, nobody talks about who is violating laws, who is illegally occupying the nations to the left and right of Iran, and who is constantly threatening Iran, whose vice president recently declared that Israel as a sovereign state has the fundamental legal right to attack Iran. You know, that will be with our weapons, with our money flying over our airspace in Iraq. We will not have clean hands if that's the way they go.
It is a very dangerous time right now in the Middle East. In Gaza, more Israeli rockets. Israel saying they were retaliation. Again, you know, Hamas fired first is what they say. It's unclear because the newspaper Haaretz has reported that the Israelis fired first.
Retaliation for, even if it had been retaliation, was thousands of times disproportional. And it made absolutely no sense in terms of defensive measures for Israel. Was openly about punishment and almost openly criminal. And, you know, I posted on After Downing Street a newsletter that someone sent me from Europe, from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, that was pushing for U.S. men and women to go and work in Israel for the Corps of Engineers and advertising Israel as the most wonderful place to live and addressing this concern about rockets by saying that, well, the few rockets they've got can't possibly hit anybody. They can only target a very limited area. No worries at all. You'll be perfectly safe. Now, these are the same rockets that were used to justify a massive slaughter of a walled-in population as an absolutely necessary defense for the existential ongoing preservation of Israel. And here is the view of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers that says, no, exact opposite.
You know, one of the other things to look at in terms of the media, and I'm thinking about your book right now, David Swanson, Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union, because you mention a few members of Congress in the book, one of them, Russ Feingold. And you say, you know, he presented his views to the president on ways to improve government. You would have asked, you wrote, him to notice that Congress makes the laws. Can you just explore that a little bit and tell us maybe who some of the stronger members of Congress, of the House and Senate, might be who could actually help implement some of the changes that you've called for in Daybreak?
I wish there were some, you know. The Senate is pretty hopeless the way it's designed, that the disproportionate representation of different states and the filibuster, which ought to be thrown out tomorrow. There's absolutely no excuse for keeping the filibuster there and blocking all decent steps on any issue. The House is a huge uphill fight as well. You have far less support from the Democrats beginning in 2007 once they got the majority for all of the issues they used in the campaigns to get the majority of peace and justice and balance of powers and workers' rights and health care. And you have far less support come 2009 than you did before because so many of the Democrats take their orders from the White House. You have Jan Schakowsky, purported progressive congresswoman, saying, I'm going to vote for war money now because my president wants me to. At any given moment, you have roughly half of the Congress, the first branch of our government, taking as its leader the executive because he happens to belong to their party and their loyalty is all to party. And, you know, we saw some pushback from a handful of members through 2007, 2008. We saw efforts to bring impeachment. We saw efforts to get subpoenas enforced. Without those two tools, Congress has no teeth at all. We now, in 2009, have had several good bills and resolutions introduced, including by Senator Feingold, that would be partial steps. Today, there is a hearing in which he's taking a good position on reforming the Patriot Act, and he has a new bill called the Justice Act to reform parts of that and FISA. There's a separate bill as well to repeal immunity for the telecom companies, something that Senator Obama had promised, incidentally. There are good bills and resolutions in the House, including proposals to create new committees to investigate everything. But there's nobody willing to step up and do anything that actually has any teeth to it. We've seen an impeachment this year of a judge for groping people. We have not seen Judge Jay Bybee, chief author of torture memos and the memo legalizing aggressive war, brought in at all for anything, not impeached and not even subpoenaed. Senator Leahy asked Judge Bybee, would you mind coming in? And Judge Bybee told him roughly to go Cheney himself, and that was that. Because the Congress is not only terrified of impeaching anyone from the executive branch. I mean, they'll tell you, we would be accused in the media of going after a conservative judge. Never mind that he legalized torture. That's what we're afraid of. They also won't even subpoena him or anybody else. Dozens of subpoenas from the last Congress still outstanding, and nobody being subpoenaed now because they're terrified to do it, because the Justice Department, like the old Justice Department, won't enforce them, and Congress is horrified of the prospect of having to enforce its own subpoenas and thereby restore power to Congress as a branch of government.
David Swanson, this is a very serious book. I mean, you go into a lot of the work you've done about law, war, money, the judiciary, the power of treaty and appointment, the power of the executive, of pardon, and the Cheney branch. That's a whole story unto itself that we haven't discussed, but I was surprised by some of what you reported on Cheney. And then you talk about congressional collapse, which is, I think, what you're identifying here. You know, and we won't impeach you no matter what. That's basically one of your chapters. And you talk about excuses, but then you get into these ideas. A world without empire, deterring repetition. I love that one. American militarism around the world, respecting international treaties. Spare change for real change. And then you talk about the rights that we need and that we have, changes we can make, spreading democracy to Washington, D.C. I want to turn to your chapter on thinking and just read the first few sentences where you say, "The first thing to know and try our hardest never to forget about the American people is that we're a whole lot better than our televisions tell us we are. Our opinions are a whole lot better than the corporate media would have us believe, and a lot more of us are actually working for the betterment of our society than we know." I was surprised at some of what you put in your book, Daybreak, that substantiates that. It actually surprised me to read about the scale of activism going on, and maybe we're deceived by the simplicity of locating things on the internet into thinking that the work is that simple, a click and, you know, a read. There's real hard work going on in the grassroots heartlands of America, isn't there?
There is, and, you know, people who spend many hours a day working largely on the internet are working, you know, that's what I do, but that's not nearly enough, and ordinary activism can't be just on the internet. The internet is for organizing people to do things in the real world, to do things face-to-face, to interact with their neighbors and their allies in these fights, and without that, we're done for, and we lose human empathy and everything that drives our whole agenda. But the internet allows us to communicate with each other around the barriers set up by this media cartel that controls our television and newspaper communication system. And we can and must use that tool of the internet to make sure we understand our power, because we so often are a large majority. Take single-payer health care. We are a majority, have been for decades, who think we're a minority. We think we're some fringe left-wing minority because our televisions keep telling us so. You know, I would encourage people to throw their televisions away, but more importantly, to use independent media, to use good radio shows like this one, to use websites to communicate with each other, because, you know, logically, we ought to work hardest when things are gloomiest. It ought not to matter if we're on our own. We're just a small group, but it does. It does to so many people. People have to have hope and signs of success and encouragement, and we have them galore. We just won't be told about them by our televisions. You know, we were just told that the president decided not to put a base in the Czech Republic and another one in Poland. He didn't decide that. The people of the Czech Republic decided that. They organized, a handful of people. They went on hunger strikes. Oh, what a crazy, laughable thing. They organized 130 mayors, took them to the Capitol, passed a bill, overthrew the government. That base couldn't have gone there if the Pentagon wanted it to. We aren't told such things because they show people having power. If we had democratic media whose goal was to energize and involve people, stories would be told very, very differently.
And you also cite the groups and what they've been doing. I mean, you include a lot of groups that I've never heard of here. I hate to say, because they sound like great groups. There's a National Campaign for Nonviolent Resistance. There's a group, No War, No Warming, and Port Militarization Resistance. The International Longshoremen and Warehouse Workers Union, that one I know. I did not know that they were still active and shutting down West Coast ports. Now, I remember stories about that. Very compelling. As were, you know, the situations where unions got behind boycotts of, like, Folgers coffee during the time the death squads were so ravaging the people of El Salvador. But it's worth saying here, your book has been celebrated by a lot of people, and I should add my voice in there because I think it's a very useful book, a very important book to read right now, about how we can transform the state of hopelessness we find ourselves in shortly after this big campaign about hope that was run by Barack Obama. But just comment on some of what you learned that might have surprised you about the groups you encountered and what people are doing, you know, in the trenches there.
Well, I appreciate you saying all of that, and then that does sum up well what I'm trying to do, is to get people active in a more strategic way. And I couldn't list all the good groups in the book, but the ones you named were very good ones. If people go to afterdowningstreet.org and click on coalition, you'll find a lot of groups all over the country in your area. There are groups like Democrats.com and PDA, Progressive Democrats of America, that have chapters all over the place that you can join. And there are groups that work on counter-recruitment, that work on nonviolent resistance, that work on peace and justice and civil rights and different types of activism, with chapters all over the place that are doing a great job. But it is important to figure out whether a group that you're going to participate in and give money to takes its agenda from its members or takes its agenda from elected officials in Washington and imposes it on its members. And for the most part, that is what happens with most labor unions and most activist groups. We are seeing groups go to Washington, ask the leadership of the Democratic Party, what should we go get people to rally to ask you to do? And then telling people to rally for that and censor anything else. Don't put anything else on their signs. So, you know, hold rallies for the public option, but we will not permit any posters that say single payer. Very, very self-destructive and anti-democratic. And it's funny that, you know, some of the groups with the word Democrat in their name are the most willing to go up against the party line, whereas we have labor unions and Center for American Progress and Campaign for America's Future and True Majority and MoveOn.org, by and large, in most cases, many groups, you know, doing AstroTurf, not exactly the same sort of corporate AstroTurf as we've talked about from the right, but the same in the sense of reversing the relationship with our representatives, becoming props at rallies, rallying for what they've already approved of, sort of pretending to rally for better governance, whereas what we're rallying for is actually opposition to Republicans in the next election. And that I have a real problem with. So make sure that you are working with organizations that are democratic with a small d. And some of these organizations do better and worse on various issues than any list in a book could change. You can move organizations to do better, and good organizations can be corrupted and do worse. But we have to be vigilant at that level as well.
David, what should be done about some of the harsher tactics occurring under Barack Obama and Joe Biden now? I mean, Pittsburgh, but also some of the events that have been sponsored by Tea Party Republicans as supposed grassroots. This is sort of dimming down now, but Connecticut Republican Rob Simmons challenging Chris Dodd for his U.S. Senate seat has said he's a Tea Party supporter. So it's openly supported by the Republicans, and there are Republican websites organizing this. But the tactics are extreme and in some cases violent. Is this intimidating people and making them turn away from the process? And what should we do about that?
Oh, absolutely. It's all about fear and intimidation. And we have to not be afraid of right-wing activists, and we have to not be afraid of the police and the military. And we have to, at some point, recognize as encouragement and complement of our force and our potential success when there's a crackdown, because when we ever get close to influencing anything, there is a backlash first before you succeed. But I think we have to be a little bit sophisticated in our response to the so-called teabagger movement, in that we have to address them and address the danger and address the actual crimes. But we have to stop giving them the respect and the treatment as if they are a major segment of our population, as if they are a force in our society, as if they are represented in our government and constitute half or more than half of a debate on any important topic. I mean, these are people in a fringe minority, heavily overrepresented in the corporate media, especially by Fox News, which is, in fact, a major international organization, one of the things these people claim to denounce, and which is funding and organizing, along with other corporate groups and front groups, these rallies to threaten violence against minorities. There is nothing more fascistic than all of that, and yet you have these signs held up at these rallies denouncing fascism, meaning something else by somebody else. I mean, some of this is so bizarrely absurd that you can't make any sense trying to reply to it. I think we are best off focusing on the polling done by the very same media organizations that show the positions of these groups to be small minorities, to know our own power and strength and numbers, to be absolutely fearless, and to get out there in the streets, in the offices, and put ourselves in the way nonviolently and not be scared off or associate street activism with right-wing cranks because we can't afford to stay home.
Your book has a foreword from John Nichols, and I just want to read a few sentences. John Nichols saying, "Nothing I had done could or would compare with David Swanson's contribution. I was a campaigner for the Constitution. David was the campaign."
John Nichols gives perhaps the best speeches at rallies that anyone could ever wish for because he loves to go over the top in that way. I love him for it. I love his introduction. He has a lot of insights, and I'm willing to have him call me a patriot, even though normally I don't like that word because he means it so well. But he's talking there is specifically about a campaign for the impeachment of Cheney and Bush. He's not talking in general in terms of contributions to our society.
The book is Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union. We are in kind of a terrible pregnant pause here as the Iraq War is escalated. Nobody wants the kind of protracted war that the U.S. waged in Asia for 20 years.
Well, we can't have a president taking orders from the military. The military cannot have the decision as to whether to expand the use of the military, because then there will be no restraint. And we cannot have a president making these decisions, even if he's reading public opinion polls and going with the majority, you know, because that's not dependable and is quite a fantasy. We have to have Congress saying, look, we have had Congress members, including Steny Hoyer, say that Dan McChrystal should be brought in to testify. Congress should decide whether we escalate a war, continue a war, or end a war. But Steny Hoyer and the rest of them are terrified of the idea of subpoenaing him, much less enforcing that subpoena. And yet they should, or they're just talking, they're just chattering, and that's not good enough. So, you know, I would encourage people to go to nogoodwar.org and join us at the White House on October 5th to say we speak for the majority, listen to us, not the military, but more importantly, to then go to Congress and to go to your Congress member locally. Don't have to come to Washington. No need whatsoever to come to Washington. Go to your Congress member locally and say, we will not support you. We will make your life a living hell if you vote another dime for these wars. It's our money. It's your decision. Represent us.
Thank you so much for joining us, David.
Had a great time. Thanks, Dori.
David Swanson, part of a national mobilization for peace. He's at Georgetown Law this weekend with Jeremy Scahill, Mort Halperin, too many to list, Kevin Zeese. You can find out about all of them online, whodecidesaboutwar.org, at OCT17Boston.org. You can learn more about a peace march scheduled for October 17th in Boston. You've been listening to a Talk Nation radio special produced in Storrs, Connecticut. Special thanks to WHUS Radio at the University of Connecticut and Public Affairs Director David Hazeltine. You can listen to our program at its usual time at 5 p.m. Wednesdays at FM 91.7 or online at whus.org. Our music was by Bruce Coburn, If I Had a Rocket Launcher, and by Fritz Heed, fritzheed.com. I'm Dori Smith. Our website is talknationradio.org. Write to us at talknationradio@gmail.com.